Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. Hour two has just started officially. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I'm here for you, so if you need a second opinion or you want to discuss whatever it may be, give me a call, 888-914-9149. So as everybody has been watching what's going on in Ukraine, and yes, I know there are different views on this. Some people say, well, Russia's really the good guy, and Ukraine is evil and corrupt, and I understand people who hold that view. And I think most of the other people would say, no, it's Vladimir Putin and the crazy that's going on there in this war against the Ukrainians and people freezing to death and all of it. It's just everybody's keeping an eye on that over there, and maybe not so much about what's going on in the Pacific, but Japan sure is. And the Daily Caller has got an interesting article about how Japan has reversed course historically since we beat them in World War II. And we forced them to adopt a pacifist government, a pacifist, what's the word I'm looking for? Constitution, thank you. I don't know who I'm thanking because it just came to my mind, but they've had a pacifist constitution such that their military forces are not, legally speaking, permitted to project power beyond their own borders, but they have a kind of a self-defense posture historically, at least until recently. They've changed that now. And the Japanese government has announced it's doing a huge military buildup, $320 billion defense plan. They're going to be going all in for an offensive war machine, missiles that are capable of striking China. They're building up their navy. It's just they're going in the other direction now. And I guess I have ambivalent feelings about it because historically, we know what Japan did to us and to the rest of the free world during World War II. Their military might was vast and very effective, and it took a lot for us to be able to beat them in the Pacific. So I do have mixed emotions about seeing, given their technological prowess and their history of militarism, I don't really relish the idea of Japan becoming a major power again militarily, but on the other hand, we need them to deter what's happening in China. Communist China is a rising threat, and we can't shoulder that burden alone. I mean, who's going to help us over there? Australia? That's not going to be enough. So if you're interested in the developments right now, this is new, and the Japanese government has authorized a complete 180 when it comes to building a war machine, which they're now busily engaged in doing. That's happening. And if you're interested in the article, you'll find it on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go to Kevin now in Homestead, Florida. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have about 100 questions, but I'll limit it to one.
Okay, we'll probably have room for one at least.
Yeah. So it's actually kind of urgently this past weekend. And I wonder if you have me clarify something about San Lazaro.
Okay.
As you know, in Homestead, Miami area, there are a jillion Cubans.
Mm-hmm.
And I've
heard that.
Yeah. I'm sure
I've seen that. I've had some delicious Cuban food in Miami before, may I say to you.
Yeah, but I usually go over, Homestead, I go for the Mexicans. Taco Tuesday.
Even better, yeah.
Even better, yeah.
So anyway, what about San Lazaro do you want to know? I'm not an expert on him, by the way.
Okay.
Well, all I can tell you is he's the Lazarus who was raised from the dead by Jesus in the Gospels.
Okay. So the Cuban Catholics, I guess specifically the Cuban Catholics, seem to acknowledge San Lazaro and they had a feast a feast day for him on this past Saturday, which is not the feast day that I'm familiar with from St. Lazarus that you're referring to.
And I'm not sure what the question is, though. Could you clarify it for me?
I'm trying. So, basically, I guess the question is, I kind of got the impression there's two different St. Lazarus that they're talking about.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. Well, there are. There are other saints who have the name Lazarus. So it would depend upon if they're celebrating Lazarus of Bethany, the one whom Jesus raised from the dead, or one of the other saints named Lazarus. I'd have to look them up to find out what they are, but I'm aware that there are any number of other Saint Lazaruses in the church's calendar of saints. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, maybe that's helpful. I did some internet research on Saturday about this person, because basically what happened was this family that I know that are Catholic, as far as I know, were getting ready to celebrate this St. Lazarus person on Saturday. I just kind of Googled it, and I looked up, I found an article. It was actually in the Smithsonian. There was a sociologist from Smithsonian, and the article was saying that some things about this tradition that didn't make that kind of red flags were coming up as I was reading this, and just kind of like so they were saying, for example, that the Cuban tradition, Cuban Catholics, even, which I didn't think that the Cuban Catholics would do something like official that wasn't, you know, Catholic International, Universal.
Help me out, though. I'm not sure what your question is. I'm trying to follow. I thought maybe you had a question for me. What was it?
I did. I mean, the question is basically, is their St. Lazarus that they celebrated on Saturday legitimate? Is it, if that makes sense?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if they're celebrating, you know, Lazarus of the Gospels, sure, of course it's legitimate. And you don't have to you don't have to celebrate a feast or a saint's, you don't have to celebrate a saint only on his feast day. I mean, so if it's customary to celebrate on a different day than what the church's calendar has, you know, it's not customary, but there's nothing wrong with that. It would depend upon what they understand they're celebrating. Have you asked them, like, who are you celebrating?
I did not ask them. I wasn't quite sure where to go with it. I'll double back. I'll do that.
Yeah, that's what I would do. I'd just say, hey, I'm Catholic too. And, you know, I'm aware of St. Lazarus, if we want to call him that, from the Gospels. Is that whose feast day you're celebrating? And find out what they say. And if it's vague, or they are saying, oh, no, it's the St. Lazarus from the 8th century in Turkey, the answer to the question right there. But without knowing what they are celebrating per se, I'm not really sure what advice I could give, Kevin, other than ask them.
Yeah, okay. So I understand. I can tell you what the article said.
No, it's okay. No, I get the idea. I do appreciate that. And I could understand your conundrum. Maybe if you do ask one of your Cuban friends or neighbors and they give you the answer you're looking for, I'd be interested in knowing. So feel free to call back, or maybe shoot me a note if you'd like. That'd be interesting to find out. And by the way, the way to send me an email is go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and click on connect, and you can send it to me. I appreciate it, Kevin. Thank you. Let's go to Steve now in Rhode Island. Good morning, Steve.
Hello, Patrick.
Yes, sir.
Patrick? Oh, okay. I have one or two questions, if you have time for two. One would be, I'm a Catholic, recently converted back this past September.
Welcome
home. Thank you. It was due to your radio show and Reverent Radio.
Praise God.
But my question is, I did follow the Baptist religion for a couple of years, and I have Bibles by them with commentaries from Baptist preachers. Would that be hurtful to my devotion to the Catholic faith if I read any of those commentaries?
Well, it could be, because although some of it may be fine and accurate, some of it very likely isn't. I'm not a fan. I certainly don't recommend that Catholics consume Protestant commentaries, because you'll have that mixture of truth and error there. So, as a general rule, I wouldn't encourage it.
All right. My other question is, I started reading the Catechism of the Catholic Church, and I know it's in the Bible also. It's at the beginning of the Catechism. It said that God put the instinct in man to seek his creator.
Yes.
Hello?
That's true.
Oh, okay. Now
you're on the air. I can hear you just fine.
Oh,
you don't need
okay.
to worry.
I don't mean offshoots from Catholic religion like the Orthodox and whatever, but I mean religions like Hindu and Buddhism. Now, if he put the instinct for them to seek their creator, which is that's what they're seeking, well, being a Catholic, I know the only way is through Jesus. If they never heard of Jesus or the Catholic religion, would they still go to heaven?
Well, the church teaches, always has, that there is no salvation outside the church. And Jesus himself said there is no salvation in anyone else other than him. So faith in him is necessary for salvation. And baptism is as well. So strictly speaking, if the person, Hindu, whatever, is not at fault for not knowing about Jesus, because he never heard about Jesus, maybe. I'm thinking about, imagine somebody, let's say a Hindu in India 1,000 years ago, or maybe at a time or in a place where there was never an opportunity for Christian missionaries to go there. And he just never knew. Nobody ever told him. Well, the Bible says in 1 Timothy 2, verse 4, that God wills the salvation of all men. He wills that everyone come to salvation and knowledge of the truth. So that means there must be some way that it would be possible that God could provide sanctifying grace and the gift of salvation, not because of the person's ignorance, but rather in spite of it. And it would be in and through Jesus and in and through his church, but in a way that it hasn't been revealed to us. So the church entrusts those people. We call this invincible ignorance. They just did not know, and it wasn't their own fault. So if it is their fault, if they do know and they reject it, then no, they can't be saved. But if they had no way of knowing and it's not their own fault, we entrust them to the mercy of God.
All right. Well, that's pretty much sums up the answer. I thank you for answering my two questions. And I want
to help,
you
Steve.
Merry holidays for you and your family during the Christmas season.
And to you and yours. Very kind of you, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right, Steve Rollo, the Steve Meister, asking me questions.
Making copies. Haven't heard that one for a while. By the way, a friend, actually a colleague, sent me some information on San Lazaro, and I will share it with you. So I can tell who's listening in the building, and she sent me something that is helpful. So this is an article called December 17th, El Día de San Lázaro, an Afro-Cuban Babalu Aye. Not sure what that last part means, but here we go. So 14 years ago, somebody wrote, December 17th is Babalu Aye Day in the Afro-Cuban religion. Babalu Aye is the Orisha name for St. Lazarus, who is commonly referred to as the father of the world. Babalu Aye is the Orisha who governs epidemics and heals infectious diseases. Though originally associated with smallpox, many of today's worshippers appeal to Babalu Aye for healing from HIV/AIDS. His colors are brown, black, and purple. His number is 17. His symbols are two dogs and crutches. He is portrayed dressed in burlap. He is offered white wine, popcorn, sesame seed candy, and a variety of grains and beans and seeds. Many Cubans hold a vigil starting the night of December 16th. They get together and light candles and make offerings to Babalu Aye and wait for him to arrive at midnight. Come midnight, they ask for San Lázaro to watch over them and keep them and their families safe and healthy. So that is that's all new to me. That's for sure. I didn't know anything about that. I'm looking at the picture, though, and it it's a depiction of the Lazarus in Luke 16, who was the poor man sitting on the front porch of the rich man's house and barely getting any crumbs. And we're told by Jesus that the dogs licked the sores on this man's body. Well, that's the guy who's depicted in this image. You can see his body is covered with sores and the dogs are licking them, and he's on crutches and he looks pretty unhappy and he's got a halo. So my sense from reading this is that this syncretistic celebration is a blending of the holy personage that Jesus speaks about in the Gospels and the folk religion. It's being blended with this Afro-Caribbean folk religion, and that's what it sounds like to me. So this obviously is not on the church's feast day calendar of feasts, and its meaning, it sounds, is has been much corrupted from its original gospel meaning. So you don't need to placate him with white wine or popcorn or sesame seed candy or grains or beans or seeds. If you want to ask St. Lazarus, whom Jesus describes in Luke 16, ask him to pray for you. Yeah, that'd be great. We know he's in heaven. If you want to honor him as he's described in the Gospels, great, that's good. But you don't need to placate him. You don't need to offer him offerings or any of those things. And this is maybe a good reminder to avoid syncretism, avoid mixing the gospel with things that are pagan. It's never going to be good if you do that, even though it may have a patina of Christianity. It leads people astray. And by the way, that young lady who sent this to me, her name is Karen. So I just want to say thank you, Karen. Do appreciate it. 888-914-9149. We'll take a break and we'll come right back to it. This is a full-service radio program, so I'm here to talk about whatever you want to talk about. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Today, we'd like to thank Gregory, who's listening in California, for donating his Eldorado. You can join thousands of other listeners in donating old vehicles by visiting relevantradio.com/car today.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
The weather outside is frightful.
Welcome back. The fat musical sounds of Chicago. Cyrus, have I told you I've seen them in concert, I don't know, half a dozen times?
No, I didn't know that.
Note for note, reproduction of their classics. Note for note.
I think you're listening to the album.
Yeah, it's good. Let's go to Bob now in Coon Rapids, Minnesota. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, Patrick.
Hi there.
So I have a question. So in the Bible, it says, like in Matthew, it shows like the genealogy from I think it's Abraham to like Joseph, but that doesn't make sense because Joseph isn't biologically related to Jesus.
Yes, good question. And Luke's gospel traces the genealogy through Mary. So what you see there, Bob, is a legal genealogy showing the legal connection that Jesus has through his putative father, who was his foster father, as you know, St. Joseph.
But that makes sense.
So the legal connection that Christ has through his father's lineage, who is not his biological father, that's established through Matthew's genealogy. And then the bloodline of his connection to King David is established, and further back, of course, than that, is established through his mother's genealogy because it was his mother. Did we lose Bob? All of a sudden, Bob just disappeared. Are you still there, Bob? Oh, I wonder what happened. Maybe his phone call just dropped. Sorry about that, Bob. Nothing at this end, as far as I can tell, but that's the solution there. So you're right. St. Joseph was not Jesus's biological father. He was his putative father, his adoptive father. But he nonetheless has a legal standing on the basis of his foster father's legal connection to that genealogy. Hope that helps. By the way, I want to take a moment and discourse, if I may, on something that you heard yesterday when you were at Mass. And this is because it just seems like this notion comes and goes, and people have this notion that Mary was an unwed mother. Mary, Our Lady, the Blessed Virgin Mary, was not an unwed mother. That's a trope that you'll often see on the left. I see, you know, the left, Catholics on the left, often on Twitter or other social media platforms. They try to push this trope that Mary, Our Lady, was an unwed mother. She was not, and yesterday's gospel proves it. So let me read it to you. This is from Matthew chapter 1. We're going to begin in verse 18. This is how the birth of Jesus Christ came about. When his mother Mary was betrothed to Saint Joseph. Now keep an eye on that word betrothed. When his mother Mary was betrothed to Joseph, but before they lived together, she was found with child through the Holy Spirit. Joseph, her husband, since he was a righteous man, yet unwilling to expose her to shame, decided to divorce her quietly. Why am I raising my voice? Because she was not an unwed mother. She was married to Joseph. The first stage of marriage before the couple lived together was they were betrothed. They were married. He was her husband. There would have been no point in him thinking about divorcing her if they weren't married. Such was his intention when, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take, wait for it, Mary, your wife, into your home. For it is through the Holy Spirit that this child has been conceived in her. She will bear a son, and you are to name him Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel, which means God is with us. When Joseph awoke, he did as the angel of the Lord had commanded him and took his wife into his home. Our Lady was not an unwed mother. For the umpteenth time. I'm not mad at you. I hope I don't come across like the angry dad, because I'm not angry, but I guess maybe I am perturbed by the kooky people who keep pushing this narrative that Our Lady was an unwed mother. She was not an unwed mother. She was married to Joseph, but they had not begun to live together yet. I think I've made my point. Cyrus, do you think I've made my point? Does that seem clear? Are we clear?
Crystal.
Are we clear?
Crystal.
All right. Where's Jack Nicholson when you need him, right? You're looking for the button. You're searching for the button.
We clear? Are we clear?
Better late than never.
Crystal. Yeah. Okay. So everybody, let's all say it together. 1, 2, 3. Our Lady was not an unwed mother. And anytime you see somebody pushing that silly nonsense, you open your Holy Bible to Matthew chapter 1, verses 18 through 24, and you can do a Mexican hat dance on
full
that
stop.
False narrative. I'm sorry,
full
madam,
stop.
What did you say?
Full stop.
Okay. Oh, Cyrus, did your hamburger come with a dose of misogyny today?
Your hamburger comes with a dose of misogyny.
Like, I'm sorry to break it to you, Chad.
Yeah. Man, I feel that way all the time.
Get that in your spirit.
Yes, sir. Let's go to Janice now in Fairlawn, New Jersey. Good morning, Janice. Hello, Janice. Welcome to the
Hello
program.
There.
I got a bad feeling about
I'm
this.
Here.
There we
I'm
go.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Well, I didn't That's expect okay. you to come on so quick. Okay. I'm calling because you mentioned a book that had been at one point recommended reading in England in the old days. And it was somewhat of an allegory, as I understand it, between the soul and this pursuer. And she was not particularly attractive, but he was portraying, like in the allegory, that this was God and his drawing the souls to himself.
I'm trying to remember. It sounds vaguely like a novel called Hind's Feet on High Places by Hannah Mm-mm. Hunard. It's not that?
It wasn't that, because I had never heard of it before. But it was you know, I guess this the woman in the novel or allegory, you know, was in wonderment that this man was interested in her. I don't know. That's what I got from it. But
I wonder if it could have been on a different program here on Relevant Radio. It's not ringing any bells for me. Cyrus, any bells?
No, I'm doing a quick search. I can't find it.
It was you, but I mean, maybe I'm misunderstood. I don't know. I had never heard the name of the title before.
Well, I'm puzzled now. I'm wondering what I might have been talking about. How recently was this? Do you know?
I'd say in the last month or two.
Okay. That's a mystery. I'm blanking on what that might be.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, well, maybe you'll think of it or the Lord will show. I don't know. I thought I wrote it down somewhere. And I was actually wanting to get it for my niece. Well, anyway, my niece, maybe I should just mention that I love her dearly. I want to get her a Christmas present. And she's got a lot of addiction issues. But I just want her to know she's really loved by God, and that's why that book caught my attention.
I think I might know what it is. It occurs to me that I did talk, I don't remember how long ago, a book by Gabrielle Bossis, Bossis. The book is called He and I, and it is her. I guess you could call them kind of like a diary, I guess, or meditation on her experiences of hearing Jesus, not like hearing audibly, but the deep messages or impressions that the Lord gave her in prayer. And and she was single. I don't remember anything about her being homely or anything like that, but just the intense love that she experienced from Jesus. And how she writes that. It's a very beautiful book. Could that be what you're thinking of?
I don't think that's the book, because I have heard of that one before. And it sounded somewhat like that, except that I think it was written in the story, more of an allegory, of a novel type of thing. But you had said at one point it was recommended, maybe even mandatory reading in England in the olden days, but no longer. Anyway, well, I don't know, maybe whatever, but I appreciate the He and I as well, because that is a possibility. You know, she's not she's barely a Christian, you know, if at all, but she definitely has a heart, I think, you know, because of her problems. She knows that she needs God.
Yeah.
You know, so thank you for that.
You're welcome. I'm sorry. I wish I could recall what that was. If you think of it down the road, if the name pops into your mind, shoot me an email or give me a call back, okay?
Okay, will do. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I thought there was something more, but Merry Christmas. Let's go to Michael now in Heartland, Wisconsin. Good morning, Michael.
Hey, good morning, Patrick. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, I can.
Michael's here, and we met in Chicago just as a brief reflection at the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre invocation with our wives, so it's a pleasure to speak to you again on the radio.
Well, nice to make your acquaintance.
Yes, so thank you very much. Just a quick question. We know that no one is guaranteed heaven. We all work out our own salvation through fear and trembling. I have a friend of mine who recently committed suicide. I've known him for 35 years. I believe he was baptized, but certainly is not practicing any religion at the moment, well, for the time he died. Mm-hmm. His family and everyone is saying that they're going to have an event for him at his house. They're not going to have a mass. They're saying, oh, they're very happy that he's in heaven now with the big guy and such and such. I plan on attending the event at the home, and other than saying, you know, we pray for Lord's mercy on him and continue to pray rosaries, is there anything that I should be saying or not saying, or how can I, you know, reconcile to people that I don't think there's a guarantee that we're all going to heaven?
Well, you're right about that. There is no guarantee. I mean, obviously, you have a moral certitude that God will keep his promises to you, but you don't have an absolute certitude that you'll keep your promises to God. So we are entirely capable of falling away from our commitment and being damned, God forbid. But we can say that we have an assurance that God will be true to his promises. He won't fall back on his promises. So in that sense, we do have that kind of assurance. So in this case, because the issue is suicide, I'm not sure if I understand. It sounds like these people, they're not despairing of his salvation. They're presuming his salvation. Is that right? They're not even praying for him?
I believe that's accurate, yes.
Yeah. What a shame that is. So naturally, anybody who dies, certainly any baptized Christian who dies, we should pray for the repose of that person's soul. This is why we say rest in peace. And the presumption is that it's very likely that that person needs our prayers because he or she is in purgatory, having died in the state of grace. If the person died in the state of grace, that person is destined for heaven but has to be purified before reaching heaven. So it's really, in my view, the the height of folly, especially if somebody died as a result of suicide, to just automatically assume the person is in heaven, because then you won't pray for that person, and that person very, very, very likely does need your prayers. So that's the first thing that comes to my mind. If you were in a position where you could share that with them and say, you know, you really should have a massive Christian burial for him. And the church didn't used to permit that. There was a long time when the church did not allow a massive Christian burial for those who committed suicide. But the emphasis has shifted in recent decades to more of the hopeful trust in God's mercy and salvation, and also recognition that people who commit suicide generally, as I understand it, are under some very severe external force. It could be fear, could be mental illness, it could be any number of things that are pressuring them to do the unthinkable. But I would certainly have a massive Christian burial. And even if the family won't do it, you yourself can have masses celebrated for the repose of this person's soul. And of course, you're...
Which I'm doing yeah, now for him.
That's good. Yeah, I would do that. And you may be the only one doing that for him. So that's good.
Okay, well, I want to be encouraging to the family, but I certainly don't want to be, you know, acquiescing to an assumption that's false.
Well, to the extent that you know the family well or well enough, you can share that with them and say, personally, in your grief and as you're sorrowful, I would encourage you to not neglect to pray for him. You know, keep praying for him.
Right, right. Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate the extra guidance.
Happy to help, Michael. And it was nice to meet you in Chicago, and look forward to the next opportunity to do that again. Thank you. Just as a little editorial footnote here, please, when a loved one or a friend or a colleague or someone dies, don't assume that that person went to heaven. And the reason is, not because you're being cynical or you're being disrespectful, it's because you're being a realist. And you recognize, as it says in Revelation 21:27, nothing unclean will enter heaven. So if you yourself are in the state of grace right now and you were to suddenly drop dead, like John Ritter did. Remember John Ritter from Three's Company? Kind of a racy little TV show. Lots of double entendres and whatnot, but it was an American sitcom, very popular for years. And he was really a good actor, funny, etc. And he just keeled over one day. He had an aortic aneurysm, if I'm not mistaken, where the aorta just bursts and you are done. You're done. And so he keeled over dead all of a sudden. I think he complained of not feeling well, and he like took a break from acting, and people were like, oh, maybe he's, you know, coming down with something. And, you know, next thing you know, they're announcing that he's dead. So point is, let's say that you have a death like that. And you just suddenly, you just die. That's it. No time to think or pray or anything. You just, boom, you're done. And you're in the state of grace. Well, number one, you're going to go to heaven because you're in the state of grace and friendship with God. Maybe you've been to the sacrament of confession recently. And even if you haven't been to the sacrament of confession, maybe you prayed a sincere act of contrition prayer. Oh my God, I am heartily sorry for having offended thee, that prayer. And you're truly sorry for your sins out of love for God. So if you die in that state, completely unprepared, and you're going to go to heaven. Revelation 21, 27 says nothing unclean can enter heaven. Well, okay, well, what about the things that are still on your soul that haven't yet been removed? What about the effects of sin that have been forgiven? What about the grudges or the little, you know, the little niggling things that may still be as they are in all of us, you know, the little jealousies or grudges or angers or snippiness or little nibbling around the edges of lust or whatever those things may be. They don't damn you. They're not mortal sins, but those can't go to heaven, can they? Well, no, of course not. Jesus said, blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. Corollary, if you're not pure of heart, you're not going to see God. Point being, when you die, even if you die in the state of grace, it's pretty likely that you will need some purification before you enter into glory. That's what purgatory is. That's what St. Paul is referring to in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning in verse 10, where he says the bad works of this man's life are being burned away. First of all, they're revealed with fire. They're burned away by fire. And he says this process involves suffering. And he says he will be saved, but only as though passing through fire. So he's not in heaven yet. He's on his way, but he's not there yet. And he's suffering. So when somebody dies, you should pray for that person because it very well may be that he or she is in purgatory and needs your prayers, because your prayers and your mass intentions and your rosaries and your good deeds and your almsgiving and all of those things, if you offer them to the Lord for the repose of the souls in purgatory, it helps them and it hastens their departure from purgatory so that they can go to heaven sooner. So please don't forget that, and I'll leave it at that. I'll be right back.
Buffalo girls, can't you come out tonight? Can't you come out tonight? Can't you come out tonight? Buffalo girls, can't you come out tonight? And dance by the light of the moon.
Well, what do you want, Mary? You want the moon? No? You want to listen to the Patrick Madrid show? Well, I guess he gives good advice.
That's high praise indeed. Thank you, sir. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to George in Middlesex, New Jersey. Good morning, George.
Morning, Patrick. First of all, I wanted to say that I enjoy listening to the show from a technical point, in that it's very smooth running. There's nice flow, and I love the way the call handler gets you ready for your call. It makes for a very easy listening.
Oh, thank you. That's young Thomas, by the way. He's our crack expert.
Many of the best men I've ever known in my life were named either James or Thomas, so it doesn't surprise me.
But
anyway, Patrick, I'm not shocked, but I'm outraged at the what's happened to Father Pavone. It leads me to really question where the bishops are on regard to the ultimate and most important issue of all, which is the elimination of abortion from the planet. I question the timing. Just a few months after Roe versus Wade the overturning of it was announced. And to do this a week before Christmas, so that Father Pavone cannot, I assume, legally or rightfully celebrate Christmas masses, it's scandalous, shocking, outrageous. It's a betrayal. And frankly, it's one of the worst things I've heard in quite a while. And for other priests to be gallivanting around, either being heretical or right up to the border, and Germany, we won't even go there. I'm shocked and disappointed, Patrick.
I think that you are expressing the reaction that many Catholics have today in light of the news of Father Pavone being laicized. I mean, that's as dramatic as it gets. And so acknowledging all the points that you just made, George, I'll first say I think that you're speaking the thoughts of many people in the wake of this shocking announcement. I would offer you maybe just one thing to consider. And I'd like to preface my comment, George, by saying that even though I can't say that I ever really knew Father Pavone, and you know, now, according to the Vatican, if he's no longer a priest, you know, Frank Pavone, seems so strange to say that. I can't say that I ever really knew him well, but I knew him well enough, and we had spent time briefly together any number of times and had very nice conversations. And I have always been a great admirer of the stalwart, important work that he has done over many decades, probably feels like centuries for him sometimes, but over many decades of being he's just been a tireless worker in that area of the vineyard. And I want to express publicly my deep admiration for the many great things that he's done. So even though I can't say that, you know, he and I knew each other very well, I've known enough and I knew him by reputation to know that he has done some really important work. And I think so many people whose heads are spinning this morning hearing the news feel that way. I also take note of the fact, and I recognize the irony, that there are some priests, let's just say, who are active on social media, who are actively, and usually, you know, in a sufficiently nuanced and implicit way so that they've got some plausible deniability. Oh, I wasn't saying that, but everybody knows that that's what they're really saying, and undermining the church's teaching, let's say, on moral issues, let's say on sexual issues, for example, and pushing other things that are contrary to the gospel. And those guys, it seems, you know, why do they get celebrated? Why are they left untouched? How come those kinds of problems are not resolved in such drastic ways? Well, those are decisions that I'm not privy to, and I don't presume to know why some priests are dealt more harshly with than others. I have a few thoughts and a few ideas about why that might be the case. But in any case, presenting from that, what I would say, George, is that in your outrage, in your shock, in your emotions that you just described, number one, remember, as I think all of us have to do, and that is obedience, especially in clerical life and religious life, is a sine qua non. It is something without which you're not going to have a good situation. And all priests are subject to the authority, if they're diocesan priests, subject to the authority of their bishops, and religious priests are subject to the authority of their religious superiors. And that is a foundational reality, always has been. I'm thinking about how outraged and even infuriated the followers of St. Padre Pio must have been when he was silenced by his religious superiors. He was a stupendous wonder worker, and he was bringing countless people back to the Lord through the sacrament of confession. He had the stigmata. He was an eminently very holy man, and God was making powerful use of what he was doing to reach who knows how many people for the sake of their salvation. And his religious superiors shut him down. And you probably know this story, but for those who don't, they just said, shut up and sit down. You're not supposed to be celebrating Mass anymore. You're not supposed to be hearing confessions anymore. And you just go in a corner and be quiet. And that's what he did. He evinced a beautiful and truly amazing humility. And just think, imagine if you were St. Padre Pio and you're thinking, well, God has given me the stigmata. And I can bilocate, and I can read people's souls when they go into confession. Surely I should be out there doing what I need to do. And he said, all right. So he sat down, and he was quiet, and he obeyed his religious superiors. Now, I personally see in that a hallmark of sanctity, that obedience, especially when it's difficult and even really outrageous, and especially if in any given situation, and I don't know what the bishop was like in St. Padre Pio's time. I don't know what his religious superiors were like, but let's say they were scoundrels. Let's just assume that they were scoundrels and personally wicked, and maybe they were slaves to heterodoxy, and they were trying to subvert the church, and they still had the lawful authority, even though in retrospect, they were misusing their authority in his case, but they still had the authority to say, sit down and shut up. he did the right thing because he was obedient to his lawful superiors. Now, this is part of, George, and forgive my long kind of soliloquy here, but I think it's important to touch upon this issue. This is part of the controversy, and that is one of the stated reasons for this is a lack of obedience and an unwillingness to submit to the lawful authority of a bishop, bishops in general, the ones that he had, who had authority over him. And so as an objective fact, that is something that should be taken into account. And I don't know any of the details beyond what's been reported. I've always known Father Frank Pavone to be a very good man. I've admired the work that he's done. So I have nothing but great things to say about the importance of his work. And I think he rightfully deserves credit, maybe in a particular way, for the overturning of Roe versus Wade. I don't think that's far-fetched at all. But even those good things, all of those good things notwithstanding, if to whatever extent there is an issue of an unwillingness to obey, that's a problem. And so God will sort all these things out. We can just pray for all involved. I think absolutely your point about how so soon before Christmas and now he's not going to be able to celebrate Mass, that's a real punch in the gut for any priest who is in that situation, any priest who loves the Lord. And I know Father Frank Pavone does love the Lord, so I can understand that. But still, we have to remember and remind each other about the need for obedience. Now, I'm not talking about obedience like you need to go commit a sin. No, I'm not going to be obedient to that. But if your lawful religious superior or your bishop says, I don't want you to be preaching or writing books or giving talks or doing this, you have an obligation to be obedient to your bishop. That's just a fact. And that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. And we shouldn't be in the business of making exceptions and say, well, look at Padre Pio. He's just doing such great work. Surely he should ignore what the bishop says to him, right? No. But St. Padre Pio doing such awesome work. Shouldn't he just ignore his religious superiors and do it anyway because God is using? No. He should do what his religious superiors tell him to do. That's my view. George, I'll give you the last word on this issue. What are your thoughts?
Thank you. Thank you for your explanation, Patrick. I find it inadequate in one respect only, okay. And that we have to, where is the assumption that the bishop who did this was operating lawfully and that his authority is rightful?
Well, the one thing I can say is that by virtue of being the bishop, that's where your authority stems from. So in terms of the church's canon law and the sacramental theology that the church brings to this issue, the bishop has that authority. Now, bishops come and go, and there have been great bishops and terrible bishops and everyone in between. So if the bishop is, whoever the bishop is, I'm not speaking about any particular one, but if a bishop who has care of souls and authority over his clergy, for example, if he's a tyrant or if he's doing something that is wrong and malfeasant, then he has to answer to God for that. And he can't command his clergy to do something that's sinful, but he certainly can command his clergy to say, Father so-and-so, you're not allowed to do this. And that Father so-and-so has an obligation to obey his bishop.
Thank you.
You're welcome, George. Sounds like we got a little feedback loop going on there. So we're all sad, or at least I think we should be sad. I'm sad over the news. But I do believe, as I remind myself, and I try to remind you too, is that all things work together for the good for those who love God. And so there are lessons that can be learned here. And among them would be, you know, that we roll with the punches. It doesn't mean we have to like it. I don't like getting punched. But we have to roll with the punches, pray for all involved, test all things, hold fast to that which is good, all of the above. Those are my thoughts as we contemplate the meaning of this interesting development. I'll be right back with Hour 3 right after this.